Ladies and gentlemen, children of all ages, gather round the radio. It's time for another installment of A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. My name is Michael Harrison. It's my privilege to serve as anchor of the program. It's an ensemble show, lots of great people involved. And the host of the program is Carol Marks, one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism. Here now is Carol Marks kicking off the hour in conversation with Dr. Victoria Sweet. She's been a physician at San Francisco's Laguna Honda Hospital for more than 20 years, and she's the author of a new book titled God's Hotel, A Doctor, A Hospital, and a Pilgrimage to the Heart of Medicine. It's published by Riverhead Books.
When you decided to become a doctor, your family was shocked. Why, and why did you want to go to medical school?
Well, they were shocked because when I was growing up, I had no interest at all in medicine. You know, I wasn't one of the kids who watched TV shows or about doctors or volunteered in hospitals, you know, or anything like that. I didn't want to hear about bodies. I didn't want to see bodies, and I certainly didn't want to touch them. But after, during college, I'd gotten interested in Carl Jung, especially his memoir, Memories, Dreams, and Reflections. And I loved the depth and meaning that he brought to his life. And I particularly loved how he set up his life, living by that little lake in Zurich and you know, seeing well-paying articulist patients in the morning and illuminating manuscripts in the afternoon. And so that's what I decided I wanted to be when I grew up, and that's how I got to medical school. I was going to be a union analyst. I was going to be a psychiatrist.
But after medical school and various medical career paths, mm-hmm. you came upon a book that was a record of a German nun's medical practice from the Middle Ages. And how did that book influence you?
Oh, wow. This is Hildegard of Bingen, who some of your listeners probably know her music, because since I've been working on her medicine, her music was actually recorded for the first time in 800 years. So she was a 12th century nun, and very unusually, she'd written a book about her medicine, a practical book about the way we practiced medicine 800 years ago. And when I stumbled upon it, I'd been practicing medicine myself, modern medicine, for quite a few years, and I was really fascinated by her book because it wasn't the medieval medicine with faith and, you know, holy water sprinkling on you that I expected. It was a real medicine for real patients with real diseases, but it was based on a completely different idea of the body, clearly. But I didn't know what the idea was, so I decided to go back to graduate school, but I didn't want to stop practicing medicine. And that's actually how I got to Laguna Honda Hospital in San Francisco with the eponymous, you know, God's Hotel of my book.
And the hospital was an almshouse. And for those who don't know,
yeah.
what is an almshouse? Because it's such an unusual thing to have today.
Yeah, it is. Everybody under 50 needs to definitely be told what an almshouse was. And it really comes out of Dickens in a way. But almshouse is how we used to take care of the sick poor before there was health insurance. So the almshouse was usually run by the city or the county. It would be free, and it would be a great big old sprawling place that you could send whoever you didn't know what else to do. You'd send them to the almshouse, and it used to be that every county in this country just about had an almshouse, and often also a free county hospital and a free county almshouse. They'd function together, so the free county hospital would take care of everybody who was sick, and then if they needed more care, or they were unemployed, or they were homeless, or they were pregnant, or they were had mental illness, they'd send them to the almshouse. And San Francisco was the only, seems to, as far as I can tell, the only county in the country that didn't close their almshouse in the 50s. Mostly they were closed across the country, and it's one of the reasons we have the problem of what do we do with patients who are poor who need care. It's one of the big problems we have. And the almshouse system was funky, and it was, you know, not equal, but it worked. And so San Francisco still had its almshouse, although it was called a hospital, Laguna Honda Hospital in San Francisco. But it's on 60 acres of land in the middle of the city, and when I first got there, we took care of almost 1,200 patients.
Wow.
Yeah.
And you know what, I was so intrigued by the type of medicine that was practiced there because mm-hmm. it was so wonderful for physicians because it's what you call in your book slow medicine. So what is slow mm-hmm. medicine and what are its advantages over what we have today?
Well, I came up with this idea of slow medicine not so much because it was slow, but it wasn't always slow, but kind of like the slow food, fast food movement. And I thought if I could, it was slow in the sense of the way slow food is slow, where you do have enough time and the process is important. So because it was an almshouse and it was old-fashioned, it was kind of over the hill to the poorhouse, everybody kind of left us alone. And we weren't fancy, but the one thing we had was enough time to take care of patients. And the problem with fast medicine, I mean, I love fast medicine. I love modern medicine. It's marvelous. But in the last 10 years or 20 years or so, the idea has been that doctors are so expensive that anything we can do to decrease the amount of time your doctor spends with you will save money. And that, I learned at Laguna Honda, was completely incorrect. Doctors are not very expensive, certainly not a doctor like myself, a primary care doctor. I'm an internist. I don't really cost very much for an hour of my time compared to all the tests I need to order and the x-rays and the CT scans and the MRI scans, because I don't have enough time to spend with you, understand really what's going on with you, examine you, and figure out really what's wrong. And so slow medicine is just when the doctor gets enough time to do a good job. It's kind of common sense, really. And the patient has enough time to heal. So the second piece that's going on is an idea, an also understandable idea, that the sooner we get patients out of the hospital, the better. And that's definitely true up to a point. But these days, we're practically setting up little mini hospitals in people's houses to get them out of the hospital in, you know, a day or two. And if they don't have a place to go, or they don't have family that can give them their injections, and, you know, run their IVs and give them medicines and essentially act like a registered nurse, we don't know what to do with these patients. And it's not been good for them. We get people who have to come back to the hospital a few days after discharge, a lot. So that slow medicine
true.
Also means that patients have enough time to heal and aren't pressured.
And
we
know
got to do that at Laguna Honda. We had enough time.
Doctors today don't talk to each other, so that the primary care doctor doesn't know what's going on.
Yeah,
and
that too.
There's so many things. Now, San Francisco's hospitals, as hospitals across the country, encountered a recession. And with the recession, you had some efficiency experts come in, and they spent 6 months looking around at the problems. And the thing is, I can't believe they never asked any staff members for their input on the patients.
No, and as a matter of fact, the same thing happened. The same group did the same thing with a couple of hospitals in Massachusetts, and a book was written on that, and they didn't talk to the docs. They didn't talk to any clinical person. But they mostly were economists and lawyers. They weren't doctors who came there. And they're looking around for inefficiencies. But one of the things I learned at Laguna Honda is a lot of what looks like inefficiency, so free time for the doctors to sit on the patient's bed and talk to the nurses and even talk to the therapists, they consider inefficiency, but it's actually efficient, even in terms of money. I call this the efficiency of inefficiency, that when people have enough time to do a good job, to run into each other, to find out what's really going on, it's actually efficient. It actually saves money. And I think that is my, if I have a crusade at this point, that's kind of what it is that we should put the free, unassigned time back into doctors' schedules and nurses' schedules. Because if we don't have that free time, then people can talk all they want about, you know, doctors should do this and doctors should do that. But if we don't have the time to do it, all we have the time to do is sit on a computer and enter, you know, healthcare data on the computer, we can't do anything. Our hands are tied.
And, you know, in your book, you give a wonderful example of how helpful really taking the time to observe a patient is. You talk about the mental status of a patient, and you sat with that patient a long time, and it wasn't blood work or scans that made you find out what was wrong.
Yeah, and I think that's true. And that's what I learned towards the end, because one of the things is when I got to Laguna Honda, I thought I'd only stay for 2 months because it was such a strange place. And I ended up staying there for almost my whole career, for more than 20 years, and writing this book about it because I developed. It kind of transformed the way I took care of patients. And towards the end, I realized that after all the other stuff, you know, everything I learned in medical school, really important, all the experience I had, really important, but that when just sitting down with a patient, calmly, quietly, and observing them, kind of absorbing their whatever it was, right, their discomfort, their suffering, their sense of being, was often pointed me in the clear direction of what their diagnosis was. And that was really a remarkable experience, I have to say.
Now, our show is geared to helping baby boomers and older Americans meet both the promises and challenges of our new era.
Yes.
So, Dr. Sweet, do you believe boomers are going to make a difference in the way healthcare is delivered, become the change makers that we were in our youth?
I do. I absolutely do. And that's what's really exciting. I would be discouraged if it wasn't for the boomers, and I'm one of us. I think it's a very exciting time because the boomers are now coming out of their working years, essentially. And I think we're just as clear-headed, revolutionary, narcissistic, idealistic, and determined as we were when we were in our teens and 20s. And this is a problem that we're all going to be concerned with. So I think there's an interesting alliance that's happening between this generation, the boomer generation, and the generation coming up. Because what I'm finding, I teach medical students, is the group of kids that the boomers have raised are wonderful people. They're very respectful towards us, and there's a very interesting alliance about really wanting to do something, and the boomers are now have time, they have the energy, and I think that we will transform this, and I'm beginning to think of what's going on, because it's not just flow medicine. There's all over the country, there are doctors who are doing things to practice medicine the way they want. A lot of them are doing this concierge medicine, which is a terrible name, but the fundamental principle is that they step out of the system and they say, you know what, I can't take care of 2,500 patients. I can take care of 500 patients or 200 patients, and in order to do that, I need X amount of money. And they charge patients a monthly fee to be their real doctor. And even in the last year since this book was out, 25% more doctors have dropped out of their this old way of practicing, this efficiency way, and started practices like this. And because that kind of practice is going to turn out to be more efficient and more cost-effective than a doctor who has no time except to order a bunch of tests, I think it's going to essentially be the medicine of the future. So the medicine of the past is going to be the medicine of the future, and we're going to do it.
Dr. Victoria Sweet, in conversation with Carol Marks. Her book is titled God's Hotel, A Doctor, a Hospital, and a Pilgrimage to the Heart of Medicine, published by Riverhead Books. A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues in just a moment.
Did you know there are other signs of rosacea besides facial redness, pimples, and visible blood vessels? Other symptoms may include burning, stinging, or swelling of the face, and even enlargement of the nose. Rosacea can also affect the eyes, causing a bloodshot appearance and irritation that could lead to vision loss. If you have any sign of rosacea, see a dermatologist or visit the National Rosacea Society at rosacea.org.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, I'm Michael Harrison. Here's Steve Wiseman in conversation with former NHL hockey player Derek Sanderson. His new book is called Crossing the Line, The Outrageous Story of a Hockey Original.
Derek, you went from signing the richest contract in sports history to sleeping on a park bench and eating out of a dumpster in 6 years. How does that happen?
I don't know. Well, you just take little baby steps. You had a beer and a drink and a boom, and it's in the family, and it's a... And alcoholism is a family disease. Next thing you know, you've got it. It's the ugliest day of your life. You wake up, you know, you can't quit. And then you don't know how to get help or where to start. And things get worse before they get better.
You know, you turned to a teammate who never let you down. And the one that really stood by you all the while. And actually, when you had nothing and you needed to go to rehab, Bobby Orr was there. What's Bobby Orr mean to you?
Well, Bobby is, you know, he's just a good friend, solid guy, someone you can trust in your life. And you know, he's always been there for all of us, not just me, anyone on the team and hockey players and people in general. He's just a very kind person for, you know, the being a superstar, you'd think he would be somewhat aloof, but he's not. He's just a very, very mature, you know, responsible person and a good guy.
Now,
and I went to Chicago. I heard he was in there. He was assistant coach. And after his knee wouldn't work anymore. And
yeah.
I said, I'd go there for a job. And I drunk. I didn't realize I was that bad. And he said, hey, if you want to get a coaching job here, he said, you're going to have to work at the road because you know. I said, yeah. So he walked out of his office and he pulled the door closed and I walked right into the end of it. And next thing I know, I woke up in the LI hospital and they had done tests and everything. Standing around the vet and Bobby's all told. You're an alcoholic and you got a toxic mixture of drugs in your system. You got to clear up. And that was the first time that I realized, well, what am I going to do? And I knew I had Bobby would help me, but I wasn't ready then. And I ran with all the detox and took off. Put the geographical cure. And then he got me again, helped me again. And I get sober. 13 detoxes and I get sober.
Terrific. Now, you first met Bobby Orr when you're playing junior hockey. How long did it take for the two of you to get into a fight?
Well, it was unfortunate. My father said to me, he said that we were going to, the Boston Bruins were dead last. And, they bought me when I was 12, Bobby when he was 11, I believe. And they paid $100 for me and got Bobby for $800. And when I first met him, he was about 5'7", 5'5", 129 pounds. He's only 14 years old. He's a little kid. But he was then a firefly in a bottle. I'll tell you what, he was quick. And no one could match his speed. So he was playing for Oshawa. I was playing for Niagara Falls. And all the junior players that went to the NHL were owned by the Bruins, were on those two teams. And they were going to show us off in Boston Garden, I guess, to kind of keep the season ticket holders in place. Hey, we got a future. And my dad says, well, the only two they're going to remember is Bobby Orr and the one he fights. And so I did. And it worked out that way. I was more of a wrestling match than I was. My heart wasn't in it. And nor was his. He said, what are you doing? And I said, no, I don't know. So, but he was always a good person, even when he was young. Parents are great. Arva's mom and Doug is. Dad of two worked with fabulous people and came from the right next year and humbleness and naive and he's a strong person, good guy.
What made the Bruins, they were, you know, it was called the Big Bad Bruins, but what made the Bruins so good, so dominant during that period?
Well, I was thinking about it the other day. Somebody asked a similar question. I said, well, I'll tell you what, every team we played, if the Bob took Bobby Orr off our team and give him to the others, he would be. The difference has always been Bobby. But we had an ability to, and he was a great leader, and he didn't yell at and scream and pep talks and that stuff. He played injured, he played with a lot of heart, he played hard, he played without rest. And, you know, people don't realize today, you know, they talk about guys plus 10, 12, 15 in the league. Bobby was plus 124.
Wow.
And plus minus and things like that. When you've got him on your side, it's huge. And he was very, very responsible for the success of the power play, him and Phil Esposito. And that was a dominant thing we had. So if you played tough against us, we would we'd be in the tongue box all night, and then the power play would kill you. And if you wanted to try to outskate us, we had fast guys too, McKenzie, Orr, all those guys. And consequently, that team was really well coached by Harry Sinman. And I think that's part of talking, and I know it's business. And he kept everything in check. He gave us something to think about every night. And you don't realize that until you get traded and you move away. And then I said, well, I was in a perfect place and I blew it. And I wanted to come back. But it took a while, but I did. And, you know, it never was the same. You can't take the money. Bobby said, I think you're a jerk. I'm glad you're back. And, you know, he was... That's what settled it, and having Bobby just say, if he accepted me back to the team, would you?
You know, like a lot of athletes, you lost your money, and it certainly wasn't, you know, certainly part of it's your fault, but part of it is a lot of guys get a lot of bad advice, and one of the things you've done is turned around, and you now work as an investment advisor with a lot of other athletes. What's your advice to athletes about when they get that big contract?
Don't think you're rich. The sports group at Bay State Wealth, the motto is really, number one, we take care of the player, and number two, we take care of his life. And it's family, and you got to put something away, and you got to build, and you got to save. And it's like someone telling you this is a broker or whatever, and a stranger, and you have nothing in common with them, and now all of a sudden it's me, I've been there, I get hurt, I can tell you what, money doesn't last if you don't protect it. Once you start eroding principle, that wonderful thing called compounding is also a negative when you spend it. So you try to put a plan in place and get prepared to adhere to it, put a budget in place, work closely with the wife and family. It'll work out as long as they pay attention, as long as they believe. They don't have to buy their brother a $68,000 truck, you know, with a bonus money. Invest it. Buy it when you make enough money and interest off your account, then you can buy the brother the truck. Because when you're 65 years old, that could be very possibly a $500,000 truck. Your brother. And people don't understand that, compounding of money. And even CEOs, intelligent, bright guys, intelligent people, think that they can handle it. They don't check it, follow it, and they get interested. So they don't know what they own and why they own it and what they paid for. And as long as the performance is plus, they don't question. And you should always question your financial advice.
You know, I guess the last thing I want to say is, for a young hockey player looking at the NHL today, what would your advice be to him?
Take it slow. Take it easy. You got Bartkowski, and you got Krug, and you've got Dougie Hamilton on the Bruins. They're only babies. And I tell you what, they're essential to that team's future. So those guys are Sagan. He's just a baby. He's only 20. So when you look at these guys that have all that talent and money, and you got to be careful, because I tell you, money is, Weston Adams Sr. told me, that money, you haven't been bred to it, and it's very disruptive in your life if you don't understand it. And that was, very sagely advice. I just didn't take it.
Former NHL star Derek Sanderson with Steve Wiseman. The book is called Crossing the Line, The Outrageous Story of a Hockey Original, published by Triumph. You're plugged into A Touch of Gray.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security websites. Pages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
This is a Driving Today Minute. Even though high gasoline prices have moderated somewhat, they're still quite high. It just makes good sense to do what you can do to reduce your fuel costs. The Alliance to Save Energy suggests a few easy things you can do.
Keep your car properly tuned up and change the air filter regularly, both to save gas and protect your engine. Curtail aggressive driving, according to the U.S. Department of Energy. Speeding, rapid acceleration, and hard braking waste gas and curb mileage by as much as 33% at highway speeds.
So nix the jackrabbit starts and opt instead for slow acceleration from a dead stop. Slow down. The DOE says each mile per hour you drive over 60 is like paying an extra 10 cents per gallon. Inflate tires to the proper pressure. This will increase fuel economy and make tires safer and extend their life.
This Driving Today Minute is brought to you by Bridgestone Firestone Tires. You can get more information like this at drivingtoday.com or by visiting our partners such as autobytel.com, motorsportsforum.com, and more.
You're listening to A Touch of Gray. Check out our website at atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E. That's atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare-only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare-only.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to godirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do, and I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Carol Marks is one of America's leading experts on upper demographic issues and a champion in the battle against ageism in our society. Her fabulous new book, Modern Aging, A Guide for Seasoned Citizens to Achieve Health, Happiness, and Purpose, published by Talkers Books, is a major breakthrough in providing a maturing population with vital information and inspiration to live better and more productive lives. Carol Marks offers practical strategies for juggling work, romance, and navigating the healthcare system. She is a guide through the maze of grandparenting, technology, travel, and retirement, as well as facing the sandwich generation's struggle of supporting adult children and elderly parents. Modern Aging by Carol Marks is available now at www.talkersbooks.com. That's www.talkersbooks.com.
If you plan to apply for Social Security disability benefits, there are things you can do to help speed up the usual 3 to 5 month wait for a decision. The more information you provide up front, the less time it'll take us to obtain the needed evidence, and the faster the decision can be made. Information like medical records or documentation, the names, addresses, and phone numbers of your doctors and medical facilities, information on your past employment, and more. To be prepared, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/disability and select Disability Starter Kits.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and this is the point in the program where we talk a little bit about the media, talk radio specifically. And our senior correspondent, Kevin Casey, joins us. Kevin is also the executive editor, vice president and executive editor of Talkers Magazine, the trade publication in the talk radio business at talkers.com. Kevin, I understand that there are lots and lots of good videos published at talkers.com. What can some of the folks who want to peek behind the curtain see?
Well, folks who are interested in the inner workings of talk radio have a lot to choose from. There are some fabulous panel discussions wherein folks from all aspects of the business discuss from a sales standpoint, a programming standpoint. And there's also some great stuff that folks who are interested in the personalities themselves might enjoy, who speak and talk about what they do, their craft, how they execute what they do every day. I think it's really interesting stuff for folks who would, as you said, like to peek behind the curtain.
Well, we had this big event in New York City a couple of weeks ago, Talkers New York 2013, and leaders from the industry, both behind and in front of the microphone, were there, and they were talking about what makes the business tick. And one of the things I've learned being involved with Talkers Magazine, as well as you're involved, is that people who listen to talk radio are fascinated by what goes on behind the scenes in the business. And wouldn't you agree that that's happening in almost everything, sports, movies, entertainment?
I would absolutely agree with that. It's fascinating how much people are in various industries are willing to show and the interest that the public have in the inner workings of these things.
Even on the cable TV shows like How It's Made, they show you how they make furniture, how they make devices, how they put things together. I think that that's a very interesting development, that there's no secret anymore to the magic of and the mystery to how things are done. But if you'd like to visit the inner workings of talk radio, visit talkers.com. Kevin Casey, the vice president and executive editor of Talkers, we appreciate your joining us. Again, it's talkers.com. I'm Michael Harrison, and A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues right here in just a moment.
Did you know? An estimated 16 million Americans suffer from a chronic inflammatory facial condition called rosacea, and most of them don't know it. Often mistaken for acne, there are many signs and symptoms of rosacea besides facial redness, pimples, and visible blood vessels. Other symptoms may include burning, stinging, swelling, and even enlargement of the nose. Rosacea can also affect the eyes, causing a bloodshot appearance and irritation that could lead to vision loss. Any one of these signs and symptoms can mean rosacea, and without medical help, it can become increasingly severe and wreak havoc on your personal and professional life. Rosacea typically appears any time after age 30. So if you experience any sign of rosacea, see a dermatologist for diagnosis and treatment, or for more information, visit the National Rosacea Society at rosacea.org.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
Engine.
Check.
Thrusters.
Check.
Fuel.
Check.
Computers.
Check.
Social Security.
No check, go direct.
That's right, Patty. A few weeks ago, I went online to GoDirect.org to sign up for direct deposit. It's easy to do. And I got my cash at warp speed.
Wow, it's fast and easy. I'll sign up right now to make sure I'm prepared for our next mission.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair, and here again is the host of the program, Carol Marks, in conversation now with Dr. Barbara Naderson-Horowitz. She's a cardiology professor at the David Geffen School of Medicine at UCLA and serves on the Medical Advisory Board of the Los Angeles Zoo as a cardiovascular consultant. She's going to talk to Carol about her new book titled Zoobiquity, The Astonishing Connection Between Human and Animal Health, published by Vintage Books.
Now, how did treating an exotic little monkey at a Los Angeles Zoo inspire you to write this book, and what does the name Zoobiquity mean?
Right. Well, I am I'm a cardiologist. I mean, I'm a human cardiologist. I've been taking care of patients with heart attacks and high cholesterol for many, many years. And then I had this wonderful opportunity to join the medical advisory board of our local zoo. And there I began, for the first time, hearing veterinarians on rounds. And they were talking about, you know, congestive heart failure in a gorilla or diabetes in a bear, or even obsessive compulsive disorder, you know, in one of their animals. And I started thinking, my goodness, these are the same kinds of problems that I've been taking care of my human patients for so many years. And I just had not known that, you know, animals get many of these same problems, and veterinarians know how to take care of these problems in ways that are unique and in some cases more effective than physicians. So I had this opportunity, and one day I was actually at the zoo, and there was a little monkey that they wanted a cardiac ultrasound on, and they were giving her some sedation to make her sleepy. And she was so cute, and it was a beautiful, a tamarin, a beautiful monkey. And I came very close to her to make eye contact, and kind of my intention was to reassure her. But the veterinarian put his hand on my shoulder and said, you know, please move back. You're going to scare her, actually, that kind of eye contact. Anyway, I subsequently learned that veterinarians have known that fear and stress can sometimes cause heart problems in monkeys and other animals. And what the insight for me was is that, you know, on the human end, we have more recently characterized syndromes associated with, you know, stress and fear causing heart problems in humans, but veterinarians have known about it for much, much longer. Anyway, that and many other experiences inspired me to wonder what would happen if we physicians and nurses and psychotherapists began looking at our human patients as human-animal patients. What if we really thought of ourselves as veterinarians? What insights might we have, and how might we better take care of our patients and their problems?
Well, you have so many interesting stories in your book about the way animals and birds are affected similarly by things such as humans are affected by. And you talk about the Northridge earthquake in California, where there were four times as many cardiac deaths as typical. And I would never think that birds and animals would be similarly affected by, say, an earthquake, and I guess they were.
Yeah, I mean, I was surprised by this, too. It had never occurred to me that the same kind of physical responses that we see in human beings, for example, after terrorist attacks or natural disasters, you know, there are people who do have cardiovascular events. It's not common, but there can be this really robust physiologic response to stress, to fear, which in some susceptible individuals can result in a cardiovascular problem. But that the same situation has been seen in shorebirds, birds like flamingos. It can be seen in rabbits, in hoofed animals, what they call ungulates. That this response, this overactivity of the stress response, can be detrimental to the health of some animals as well. That was news to me, and it was fascinating to think about as a human cardiologist. You know, what might that mean in terms of how we can understand the problem in our own patients?
Is there any connection between humans and animals when it comes to fainting and something really scary? I mean, that was something that I really never had thought about.
Yeah, this was really interesting to me. So, you know, I take care of a lot of patients who faint. That's one of the presenting complaints that you see as a cardiologist a fair amount. And some people faint in response to stress. Some people faint, for example, when they have their blood drawn. Sometimes when people have, they get bad news. Even pain, like when people fracture their legs, sometimes the intense pain of a long bone fracture can trigger a fainting episode. Well, it turns out this fainting in response to fear or stress is seen across the animal kingdom, and it connects to what is most likely an adaptation that's been around for hundreds of millions of years, involving a slowing of the heart rate in response to predatory threat. And we see this in animals from mammals to reptiles, even some fish will slow their heart rates down profoundly when there's a predator around. And the theory is that by profoundly slowing the heart rate, it stills the animal and makes them somewhat hidden from the predator, and may actually serve as a kind of last-ditch survival strategy. And the theory is that we have retained that heart slowing response in the presence of danger or stress or fear, and that is what connects those intensely emotional moments to fainting in humans.
So when it comes to a very dangerous situation, I guess humans can do three things: fight or flight or faint.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, we're all taught that that our response to stress is the fight or flight, and that's this, you know, the adrenaline surges and the heart rate, you know, races, and that, you know, blood vessels constrict, preparing us to flee or to fight. But it turns out there is this third sort of option, let's say, this third response, which involves a physiology of hiding. It's the physiology of fainting. So it's not just fight or flight, it's fight, flight, or faint.
Now, as a cardiologist, one of the issues you've got to be interested in is the connection between depression and heart disease. Have you looked in the animal world and seen if there's any connection there?
You know, we were really interested initially in just looking at physical commonalities. We learned about, you know, the animals that get breast cancer, you know, lions and tigers, and And we learned about diabetes, and we learned about congestive heart failure and all of these kinds of physical problems. But at a certain moment, we decided that we should ask the question, at least, well, do animals get some of the same psychiatric problems that we have? And we looked at disorders ranging from, you know, depression to eating disorders to anxiety to even self-injury, you know, what psychiatrists call cutters. And we actually found that, yes, indeed, there were wild examples and some domestic examples of all of these syndromes that had been described by veterinarians over the years. We learned, for example, you asked specifically about depression, but let me just talk first about anxiety, because anxiety disorder, which of course is common in humans, is a very important problem that veterinarians have to deal with. Companion animals, dogs and cats, can develop what's called generalized anxiety disorder. They can develop phobias. Thunder phobias are common. They can develop post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD. And, of course, the way that veterinarians deal with these issues are fascinating, because they can't do psychotherapy with their patients, but they have very effective strategies for looking at the environment and understanding what triggers those issues. We were also particularly interested in looking at the issue of compulsions, a kind of a dog version of OCD called canine compulsive disorder, and self-injury, which is very common on the human side, but it turns out is unfortunately common on the animal side as well. So there are many, many connections between psychiatric disorders in humans and the many behavioral disturbances that are seen in cats, dogs, many birds, and other species.
You know, I found it all so interesting. Now, it turns out then that veterinarians and physicians have both been dealing with the same kinds of problems: depression, anxiety, obesity, cancer, diabetes. We can go on and on. And yet, as you point out so tellingly in the book, they don't know anything about each other's fields. They haven't been sharing information. And do you have any comments about that? Because it would be so good if veterinarians and physicians got together to work on their common problems.
Right. Well, I have to say that I think that the blame, frankly, I mean, there are a lot of reasons why veterinary and human medicine have not had enough connection over the years. But more recently, I think veterinarians have been reaching out through the One Health movement to really forge bonds and make these contacts. But on the physician side, on my side of the equation, I think there's been an inadequate recognition of how much the veterinary world has to offer human medicine. And really, one of the goals of Zubiquity was to look at all of these conditions that physicians take care of, not just infectious diseases, but, you know, eating disorders, anorexia nervosa, bulimia, food hoarding, binge eating, and point out the animal correlates of these problems and how veterinarians are dealing with these issues. That's why we really tried to center the chapters on topics that people who are charged with taking care of human beings would be dealing with. We have a chapter called Fat Planet, where we look at overeating and obesity in the animal world. And, you know, it doesn't matter what kind of physician you are these days, you're dealing with overweight patients, obese patients. It's a big problem. And before, by the way, before writing this book, I had no idea that there was an obesity epidemic among companion animals. Vets tell us that about 40 to 50% of our cats and dogs are now overweight to obese. Actually, remarkably, there have been cases of veterinarians having to perform liposuction on some dogs. There's a diet pill that is out there for pet obesity. So, you know, there's much that we can learn from how vets are dealing with these really common problems. But because physicians are very unaware, I mean, I was very unaware of, you know, how much of the same pathology existed on the animal side, we don't even think to ask the question of what's happening on the animal side and what are they doing about it.
That's Dr. Barbara Naderson-Horowitz in conversation with Carol Marks. Her book is titled Zubiquity, The Astonishing Connection Between Humans and Animal Health, published by Vintage Books. Coming up next, Steve Wiseman joins us. He's going to talk about Medicare fraud. When A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups, continues.
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
You want a piece of me?
They're not movie tough guys, just ordinary people doing something extraordinary. They're all signed up on MatchingDonors.com, willing to donate their kidney to anyone who needs it. In the U.S., 19 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant, most of them for kidneys. MatchingDonors.com improves those odds by finding living, altruistic donors for patients desperately needing transplants. Go to MatchingDonors.com and meet some extraordinary people. That's MatchingDonors.com.
Want to stay informed when there are changes to Social Security? Subscribe to receive automatic email updates on popular Social Security webpages with the click of a button. Just visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. More than 1 million people already receive updates to the pages they're most interested in. You can too. Look for the red envelope followed by a link that says Get Email Updates. To learn more, visit www.socialsecurity.gov/govdelivery. Social Security delivers.
Hi, this is Morgan Freeman. Has anyone ever said, you are the picture of health? You look healthy, you feel fine, but that may not be the full picture. Colorectal cancer is the second leading cancer killer of men and women over 50. Since it doesn't always cause symptoms, you may not know you have it. The only way to know is by getting screened. Screening can find precancerous polyps so they can be removed before they turn into cancer. This is one cancer you can prevent. Plus, screening can find colorectal cancer at an early stage when the chance for a full recovery is very high. Talk with your doctor and get tested for colorectal cancer. Medicare and many insurance plans help pay for screening. Get screened. Make sure you are the picture of health.
A message from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
Hi, I'm Sigourney Weaver. If you're like me, your dog or cat is part of the family, and they rely on you to take care of them. Like a family doctor, your veterinarian and staff know what's best for that special family member. So visit your vet regularly for checkups, for prevention of disease like heartworm, and for the best advice on everyday issues like flea and tick control. Your veterinarian knows best, so take the time to ask questions. For healthy pets, visit the vet.
A message from the American Animal Hospital Association.
You're age 65 and you've made your decision to keep working and delay receiving your benefits. That's fine, but don't forget about Medicare. Most people should apply for Medicare coverage within 4 months of reaching age 65. And there's a fast, convenient, and simple way to apply for Medicare in as little as 10 minutes. Online at www.socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only. That's socialsecurity.gov/Medicare only.
Continuing now with A Touch of Gray, the talk show for grown-ups. I'm Michael Harrison in the anchor chair. And before we bring Steve Wiseman on for you, I want to remind you that if you like the interviews and the discussions you hear in this program, there's a whole bunch of them for you to choose from at atouchofgray.com, our website. atouchofgray.com. Gray is spelled with an E. Please check it out. It's good. And now, speaking of good, here's a man who stands for truth and justice in the American way, Steve Wiseman, our senior correspondent. He's written the book, The Truth About Avoiding Scams, published by Prentice Hall. He has a website called scamicide.com. This guy doesn't like scams. He doesn't like fraud. As a matter of fact, he's here now to talk about Medicare fraud. Steve?
Thank you, Michael. You know, Medicare fraud has become a real major problem of fraud, waste, and abuse. And lately, though, the government has been taking some real steps to try and reduce this. And one of the big things they're doing is they've redesigned the so-called Medicare summary notices. These are the bills that you get, and even if you're not paying anything, they're the notices that tell you about what medical care you've received and what kind of coverage you're getting through Medicare. And a lot of times people didn't really pay attention to these because in many instances they knew they weren't paying the bill. Medicare was paying it, so what? But the so what is that so much fraud has come about with people's Medicare numbers being stolen and hacked into and then used to access services or to pay providers for services that were never provided. So this is something that's really important. And now the Center for Medicare Services has a new Medicare summary notice. And this is going to make it a lot easier for people to understand what it is in the benefits, how to file an appeal if your claim is denied. But particularly, it's going to help you spot claims for services that have never, ever been received. And this is it, because in the fight against Medicare fraud, which is important for all of us, particularly, you know, as the government is trying to make healthcare more efficient financially, we need the public to be part of this. And the thing is that the government has really stepped up its efforts. They've revoked 14,000 providers and suppliers' ability to pay in the Medicare programs just since March of 2011. And they were taken out because a number of these places were not following the rules, had felony convictions, or weren't even operating at the addresses that have been on file. And in a lot of the states, these revocations of providers have quadrupled since the Affordable Care Act was first put in. So this is the kind of thing where the government is really making an effort. Over just the last 4 years, the Obama administration has recovered close to $15 billion in health care fraud judgment settlements and various administrative court impositions. Actually, in 2011, it was a record. In 2012, it was a record. So we're all in this together. It is something, when you get your new Medicare summary notice, look through it. Look through it every time you get one of these notices. And if you do see something that shouldn't be there, do file an appeal. Do contact Medicare. And all in this together, we can make it work.
Thank you, Steve, and that's the latest about Medicare fraud. Again, The Truth About Avoiding Scams is Steve Wiseman's book, published by Prentice Hall. And scamicide.com is the place to go to find out every day the latest scam of the day. Well, that about does it for us. You can visit us at atouchofgray.com. We spell gray with an E, atouchofgray.com. I want to thank Beverly Santinella on the front line, our producer, putting it all together. Carol Marks, the host and founder of the program, It's Guiding Light. And Steve Wiseman, Kevin Casey, the entire Touch of Grey broadcast team, on behalf of all of us, I'm Michael Harrison, inviting you to join us next weekend right here for another installment of A Touch of Grey, the talk show for grown-ups.